Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. Dave!
Melody, happy Dave. Spring! Happy spring!
It's yes, not
it's
spring.
Arrived again, finally.
Today?
Spring officially begins on the March 19th. Or vernal equinox.
Yes, it does.
Year, it's the 19th. That's when the amount of sunshine and moonlight are about 12 hours long each.
Happy days are here again.
That's right.
Doo-da.
Yeah, baby. Yep, it happens on March 19, 20, or 21 every year in the Northern Hemisphere. And in the Southern, this same event marks the beginning of fall. I don't know about you, but I'm already enjoying the warmer sunshine during the day and slightly less cold nights, plus all the crocuses and daffodils popping out all over the place. So happy spring. Mother Earth just keeps on turning.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Yes, I'm enjoying, although it's a little nippy. It's still a little nippy. It's windy. We've had wind, which takes the temperature down. But tomorrow we are supposed to be in the low 60s. So I'm so ready for it. So ready. So let's go ahead and see what the markets did today. Gold today was just down a little bit, $3, $2,160. Silver was down 16 cents at $25.10. Platinum was down another almost 2.5% at 898, and palladium was down an almost, 3.5% at 1004. The paper markets, the Dow was up 320 points, still under 1%. The S&P was up a little over 0.5%, and the NASDAQ was up just 63 points. European markets were all positive, all like 0.25%, maybe a little bit more, but nothing exciting. Even the European markets are looking ahead to the Fed meeting. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Such a joke. But Asian markets, the Nikkei was up, which is surprising. It was up over 40,000. And we're going to talk about that here in a little bit, that the Bank of Japan raises rates for the first time in 17 years. Not quite sure how long it's going to remain above 40,000, but who knows? When these markets are rigged, I suppose they can do anything they want to do. 10-year yield was down a little bit, 4.296. Oil up 76 cents at 83.48. Natural gas was up 2.5%, 1.747. 1.747. So it is kind of interesting. The markets, it's shocking. And, you know, again, even the European markets are looking for the, excuse me, the Fed meeting that started today. And everyone is looking, everyone thinks that a recession will be avoided. And unlike some of the past surveys, they don't even see growth slowing much below potential in the next couple of years. Well, I think, is it based on the growth that they're seeing today, Dave? Slowing from today? Well, today's growth partly is pretty paltry. It's pretty paltry compared to the past. So that's not really saying a whole lot, except that it's not going to get worse. But they're not saying it's going to get better. John Donaldson at the Haverford Trust Company said, for now, the narrative that the U.S. economy is so fragile that it cannot survive without ultra-low rates has been debunked and discarded into the rubbish bin of history. Yeah, I don't think it's yet to be discarded into the bin of history. The March survey finds that the average probability of a soft landing at 52%, up from 47% in the January survey. On the other hand, I wouldn't exactly call 52% a great narrative for a soft landing scenario. On the other hand, it's the first time that it's been above 50 since the question was first asked last July. And they talk about the probability of recession in the next 12 months fell to 32%. This is the lowest since February 2022. Things are just heating up. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, there's a guy, Scott Wren, at Too Big to Fail, Wells Fargo Investment Institute, who said the economy continues to move forward toward a modest growth and modest inflation environment. Okay, well, we'll see. This may take longer than initial expectations, but the trend is nevertheless favorable. Well, forecasters we know have a bad track record of predicting recessions. The respondents to this survey, among them economists, strategists, and fund managers, joined other forecasters in the past year in being fairly certain that a recession would hit in 2023. That turned out not to be the case officially, other than perhaps the housing industry and some other aspects of manufacturing. But while the recession probability is down via this survey, about 20%, of respondents still say there's an even money chance or greater of one over the next year. So 20% is a distinct minority, but it's not insignificant either. You got Robert Fry of Robert Fry Economics saying he has a 60% recession probability and sees the Fed slashing rates to around 3.5% by the end of the year. From the current median level of about 5.4. Overall, the survey respondents still see 3 rate cuts this year on average, which would bring the fund rates down to about 4.6%, assuming 25 basis point cuts. About 2/3 of CME future traders, 68%, see a probability of 3 25 basis point cuts by the end of the year. Half of the survey respondents believe the biggest risk is that the Fed cuts too late, while a little less, 46%, worry the Fed will cut too early. Significantly, inflation, high inflation, is still judged to be the biggest risk to economic. We'll know more tomorrow, Melody.
It's not what they do, it's what they say. And has bigger impact. And, you know, again, what's he going to lower it? You know, a quarter point. I mean, it's not going to have any major impact. It's all a psychological impact. And we'll have to see where he goes from there. But this year is far from being over as far as whether it's going to be a soft landing or a hard landing. I says, with this being an election year and all the craziness that's going on, and, you know, we can talk about all the good numbers here and everything else, but what about around the world? Is the world really doing all that well? And again, it depends on what level that you're at as to whether you're doing well or not. So again, this country is being divided now. Not only have we been divided politically so strong and in so many different ways, but now they're totally dividing us economically. And because you got, you know, half the people that might be doing fine and the other half that are scrambling in the streets, they're finding it more difficult to do with the prices of food and their housing and cars and so forth. And they're struggling. There's a group of people in this country, but they seem to be ignored. And so, and it isn't about, you know, again, you know, so what's the solution? I don't know. But I'm not sure there is a solution. It's just going to continue to go on, and it's going to continue to get worse. This country will be continued divided, and eventually there will be a reaction. Where there's an action, there's a reaction. The problem is we've never seen these. We haven't seen any true reactions. So, bailing out these too bigs to fail isn't an action. The real action would have been allowing to, when they fail, to see the true reaction to that. So the bailouts was just part of the initial. So again, it's really messed up. It's truly messed up. Japan, their central bank finally ended its experiment with negative rates today. Japan's largest federation of trade unions said ongoing wage negotiations between Japan and unionized employees have so far yielded an average 3.7% spike in base pay. That's what forced the Bank of Japan's decision came just after that. This was even more robust than last year's gains, which were the steepest in three decades. The governor of the Bank of Japan repeatedly said these talks would be key to sustainable price increases that would inform any decision to hike rates for the first time in 17 years. But BOJ policymakers expect higher salaries to lead to a virtuous spiral with a domestic demand fueling inflation. Well, that's a bright future for them. Before today, the Bank of Japan had barely budged from its ultra-loose monetary policy posture despite the core inflation exceeding its 2% target for more than a year. And Dave?
Well, they're saying now that the BOJ will look to use its short-term interest rate as its primary policy tool by employing an interest rate of plus 0.1%. The current account balances held by financial institutions at the central bank starting in 2 days, the 21st. At the same time, it supposedly will encourage the uncollateralized overnight call rate. That's another policy-oriented interest rate used by the BOJ to remain at around 0.01, effectively raising interest rates from their current negative 0.1%. Right after the BOJ announcement, Japan's three largest banks announced they would raise interest rates on ordinary yen deposits. So the decisions sparked a sharp sell-off in the yen, sinking to more than 150 yen to the dollar. That level previously prompted intervention from Japanese authorities. So we'll see where that goes, but a big move in Japan.
Yeah, I talked about this before, that with the error of their negative interest rates, I mean, it's going to have enormous implications for world markets. The U.S. treasuries are set to suffer because of this. So there's a lot that can happen when you're at negative rates for 17 years. That's a long time. Well, I guess it was 2016 that they actually went into negative, but they've been lowering rates, I guess, since way back when. But yeah, there's talks that it's going to affect all markets. The biggest consequence, perhaps, could be more turbulence for the amount of vast amount of treasuries. And that's because higher yields in Japan would, of course, fund repatriation by Japanese investors whose huge holdings include U.S., European, and Australian debt. So will that happen on a knee-jerk reaction? No. I wouldn't think so. But eventually, you're going to see it. And but coming back here to the States, you see inflation does mean different things. If you look at prices that are top of most of us, inflation turns out to be extremely high. Now, we talk about here every single day. And that inflation is not going to go away. And it's always higher than the headline consumer price index. And now, supposedly, it's at a very benign 2%, according to the government. You have these ultra-broad measures of inflation, like the PCE or the GDP deflator, tend to be of interest, mostly to macroeconomists. The most well-known measure of inflation that we report on is the CPI. That's supposedly more focused on things, individuals that we spend money on. You know, it includes all types of things, window coverings, you know, whatever you plant in your garden, vacations. So a lot of times people think, or we'll talk about inflation, maybe on a little bit smaller group. Most of these prices are big enough to be meaningful in the context of a family budget, seen and thought about frequently and paid out on a regular basis, ensuring that any increases get felt almost immediately. And, you know, we do look at the three most relevant prices in our economy, which is gas, groceries, and rent. Dave.
Yeah, and if you weight those three according to how they're weighted in the CPI and chart how they've changed since 2017, we see that gas prices were a no-brainer. They're the most visible price in the country. Flashed at drivers at almost every intersection in, throughout the U.S. Grocery costs have been driving much of the household table discussion around inflation the past couple of years and are something that affects every family. On average, I read that over the past couple of years, the grocery prices are up a cumulative 18% from where they were before the pandemic started. Rent, a little less universal. Most Americans own their homes rather than rent, but rent's overwhelmingly important to almost everybody who pays it. It's also a large part of the reason why the cost of housing has become so political. Now, the gas, food, lodging inflation chart spiked 18% in June 2022, then briefly turned negative a year later when gas prices fell pretty fast. And the peak of gas, food, lodging inflation was double the 9% peak in headline CPI. This time last year, it was still above 7%, but since then has come down some. This particular series is volatile, but since the middle of last year, it's hovered at decidedly less worrying levels, according to this story. Last month, it came in again at just 2%. Bottom line, we could be reaching the point where Americans are becoming accustomed to higher, but hopefully no longer sharply rising prices. And that's the point, economists say, at which inflation worries tend to start dissipating. We shall see.
You know, it's really incredible, you know, that and it's people. I mean, whatever we get thrown at, we get used to. Perhaps that was the problem. But you also get used to going into a break at 4:20 Eastern time, and that's where we're at right now. So we'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Talking away. I don't know what to say. I'll say it anyway. Today is another day to find you shying away. I'm coming for your love, okay?
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, 1-800-375-4188 for Discount Gold and Silver Trading. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. Dave?
Yes.
Do we want to say anything more about inflation?
Well, only to the extent, you know, the Fed's meeting as we speak, day one of its two-day meeting every 6 or 7 weeks. And, you know, they're saying that the Fed has big choices to make. Now, the choice has already been made as to whether or not they're going to monkey with interest rates. They most certainly will not tomorrow, but... all eyes seem to be on the good old dot plot projections and how they're going to characterize their projections for moving forward. Will they, you know, they're going to do 3 cuts, 2 cuts, 1 cut, not commit to any? And as you say, it's what they often say as opposed to what they do or don't do. That moves markets in this country. So
yes.
we'll see.
I think we've seen that with a 300-point increase in the Dow today. I think that's a prime example.
That surprised me. I thought there'd be a more emphasis on sort of pushback on the Magnificent Seven, NVIDIA in particular, since the end of its AI Woodstock, which I'll talk about in today's third segment. Apparently, market's still focused on the Fed.
But wasn't that increase today mostly on NVIDIA?
It turned around. NVIDIA actually fell back a small amount with some investors. I don't know if it was an underwhelming response to their CEO's keynote speech yesterday, where he laid out this new generation of AI soft hardware, if you will. I don't know. I guess we'll see tomorrow. You know, if there's a surprise one way or the other, and again, I don't think there will be, but if there is, it will almost certainly be in the projections. And that in and of itself could move markets, particularly, well, I was going to say particularly the stock market, but it would affect treasuries and gold as well. Particularly if they're going to say, you know, rates will be higher for longer. Now, if it stays characterized on, you know, we're still on a path of downward inflation or a 2% target, then I think gold has a good day, as will equities. But I mean, it's a guessing game. Whether it's an educated guess, I guess is debatable. But we won't have to wait too long. I mean, in less than 24 hours, we'll have those new projections and Jerome Powell's press conference at 2:30.
Well, it is the casino.
Mm-hmm.
It is a casino, so guessing is good.
Yeah, really.
You know, we talk about the various real estate and areas of the country, and again, this is something that I don't know if how much of an impact it's going to have, but when you're looking at offices in some of our biggest cities, there aren't even 2/3 full on some of the busiest days of the week. And 4 years after the lockdowns began, kids are back in school, brick-and-mortar retailers are doing decent, travel has rebounded, but remote and hybrid work has lingered. The shift away from working in offices have touched nearly all aspects of our lives, from where people live, how they structure their work-family balance to the way companies run. And nearly a third of leases are set to expire by 2026. Peak office days are typically Tuesday or Wednesdays, can gauge the return to office momentum. They're also a pretty useful measure for employees who need to have space available for everyone who wants to come to work in person. You know, it's funny, Dana. I had a conversation with a fairly big company this weekend. Their employees, and of course, I'm always the, you know me, I'm in there having to, you know, and I asked them because this topic came up about how they were able to work at home and how, you know, they want to do this and how they want to do that. And I says, well, you know, I says, it used to be that, you know, whatever the boss said, that's what you did. And I mean, it was just kind of like I was a dinosaur. And it was, I was not shocked, but it's just amazing. You know, it was kind of like they kind of agreed, but yet then, you know, it's like, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I don't think it'll ever change. So yeah, I think this is going to be very important still in the future.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen this, this growing trend, huge in southeastern PA, but also in other major cities, where malls and office space being converted to apartments, condos. Office occupancy is close to 62% on these high attendance days, but falls to around 35% on Fridays. And that's in the 10 big cities, including the four largest, New York, L.A., Chicago, and Houston. The numbers were in the high 90% occupancy range before the pandemic struck, when it nosedived to below 20% before gradually rising again over the ensuing 3 years. One commercial real estate agent said that some top Manhattan landlords who don't use this one company, Castle Systems, are seeing higher occupancy rates, and remote listings are dwindling on job sites. That could be foretelling that in another year or two, we might see these vacancy rates start to fall again. But right now, partially empty office buildings are literally roiling the commercial real estate market. And real estate investment trusts and investors apparently looking to scoop them up on the cheap. So we'll see what happens. It's a significant, turn of events, Melody, that affects our inner cities, affects our inner and inner suburbs, where these big class, so-called Class A office buildings are mostly located. Particularly with interest rates coming up, you know, as loans, mortgages come due, or bonds come due, it'll be interesting to see how, if we're going to start to see more and more failures, commercial office failures in the coming months and years before it perhaps turns around. We may have lost Melody for a moment, but let me just say, while inflation is 10 times higher now than 60 years ago, home prices are 24 times more expensive, according to a new study. If home prices increased at the same rate as inflation since 1963, the median price of a typical house in the U.S. would be a mere $177,500, according to Clever. That's a real estate data company. In fact, though, the median price for a home in the U.S. is now close to $413,000. According to Redfin, Matt Brannon, who's a data writer at Clever and the author of this report, says today it's harder for adults to buy homes than it was for their parents' generation. Yes, indeed it is. And while mortgage rates have contributed to a portion of the higher costs, supply and demand have also affected the price growth, particularly here in the U.S. Brannon said when demand for other consumer products comes up, or when it increases, it's usually not too hard for people to scale up supply, whereas houses take months to build. In fact, the average time to complete a newly built single-family house is close to 10 months, according to a survey conducted by the Census Bureau. Plus, you got zoning restrictions along with land costs that also make it hard to even secure the approvals for a developer to build a new home. Now, to increase housing supply, local policymakers would need to lower these barriers for builders by easing land use and zoning regulations. And, well, that's usually a hard sell. I mean, we do live in a NIMBY world, not in my backyard. I'm going through that very thing on a personal level, where the last bastion of open space in my small community, 24 acres, is being proposed for development of upwards of 120 new single family and townhouses adjacent to a, well, probably 150 year old neighborhood of largely twins. And of course, they'd love to see it preserved as it was. It was a Christmas tree farm prior to this development proposal. Anyway, the affordability crisis for homes in the U.S. It's a big political issue now for many Americans. Well, Redfin found the current housing affordability issue makes 64% of owners and renters have negative feelings about the economy. And particularly in a presidential election year, that's not good for an incumbent who's running for re-election. In fact, affordable housing is a pressing topic for both liberal and conservative voters. Topic is ranked as the number one issue for liberals, while it's number three for conservatives. That's according to a separate survey by the Real Estate Witch. Now, to address the issue, President Biden has called on Congress to pass a mortgage relief credit that would provide a $10,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers, and a similar tax credit of up to $10,000 to families selling their starter home. Separate action last month, the White House, the Federal Housing Authority, and Ginnie Mae announced an increase on loan limits and broadened lender requirements for the Title I manufactured housing lending program. I think you're back.
I am.
Good to have you. We lost you there for a minute.
Yeah, I have no idea what went on. Weird things are going on. But so yeah.
Undoubtedly it's AI.
Of course it is. Of course it is. AI. You know what, it was funny. I'll just tell you this week. This is kind of humorous. You know me. I'm always I just ask too many questions. And I was with a lot of Microsoft people. And I was asking them about AI, and they were saying, oh, AI is blah, blah, blah. And I says, yeah, but, oh, AI is going to, I says, well, yeah, but isn't it just people who put the information into AI? You know, and I was being naughty as far as, you know, asking them. They probably thought I was nuts, but I thought I was being naughty.
It's an important question to ask and for others to ponder.
And, you know, he says, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I says, well, I said, it's also mathematical, isn't it? He kind of looked at me. He says, yeah, you're right. Because he was talking about how AI, you know, takes this information and it'll be able to, because they were talking about how AI thinking that. And I says, well, AI really isn't quote unquote thinking. They're using equations, math equations, and the input that, and you know, to come together, and the speed of the computer and to spit it out. And you know, they changed the topic.
Yeah, well, the uncertainty though lies in whether these AI robots, computerized programs become sentient. Will they learn the ability to learn further without being told?
I don't believe that.
And therein lies the danger.
Where I think the danger is, it's not that they're going to be able to think and come up. What I believe is the people that are inputting the information, the equations and so forth, they don't know the answers. They don't know how, and I don't think it's thinking the way we think that it's thinking. It's not going to come up and think on its own. It's just going to come back with answers and information and, I don't know, that we just didn't anticipate.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, if that's the case, then you know, because it's somewhat more controllable.
Not really, because if you don't know, you know, it's like the attorney asking the guy up on the stand. You don't ask a question unless you know the answer.
Right.
So
right,
in that right. respect, the answers, because it's about control. It's still lack of control.
Well, it's control in the sense of if an individual programs AI to do something rogue or, you know, unwanted, it can then be undone by somebody else. But if the AI becomes sentient, then we got a problem, because nothing may be able to reverse it.
We have a problem. We're heading into a break. We'll be right back, though. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody, take care of other business's final segment. You can reach her at 1-800-375-4188. Hey, the transatlantic economy is now an $8.7 trillion flow of trade, investment, and labor between the U.S. and Europe. And Bloomberg's Brendan Murray writes today that the market is withstanding a period of reglobalization with all the stiffness of James Bond martinis. He notes that Shaken, Not Stirred is the title of chapter one of a just released report from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, AmCham EU, Johns Hopkins SAIS, and the Transatlantic Leadership Network. The 007 line is, of course, a fitting metaphor for a trading relationship wobbled but still standing more than 2 years after Russia's war in Ukraine began. The 200-page report states this: the U.S. and Europe remain each other's most important markets and geoeconomic base. No two other regions in the world are as deeply integrated as the U.S. and Europe. The report paints a rosy picture of a long economic relationship that's been stained recently at the policy level between Brussels and Washington. Now, the report was also released the same week that a different report on competitiveness warned that Europe has been significantly losing relevance as an economic powerhouse. According to the Transatlantic Trade Report from the Chambers, here are some 2023 records that back up the theme of commercial cohesion with the U.S. in an otherwise fragmenting world. U.S. Europe goods trade hit an all-time high of $1.22 trillion, more than double the goods trade between U.S. and China. And U.S. goods exports to Europe were also a record last year. Europe became the top purchaser of U.S. crude oil and accounted for more than 60% of American shipments abroad of liquefied natural gas. Plus, U.S. company affiliates in Europe earned an estimated $350 billion, and European in the units in the U.S. made $190 billion. Bottom line, the report said, globalization is not dead, but it's being refined and reconfigured. Now, the same uplifting story can't necessarily be said about flows of foreign direct investment, FDI for short. The report said that during the first 9 months of 2023, U.S. FDI in Europe was down by almost a third. An investment going the other direction dropped not quite one third, 30%, trends that they think will continue this year. The board said we would not be surprised if investment flows remained weak again in 2024, given uncertainty surrounding elections in the U.S., across Europe, and in many other countries around the world. It continued, the risk to investment flows is that firms take a wait-and-see attitude towards these elections and hold off spending until after the voters are heard. That's never good for an economy. Now, cheaper borrowing costs this year may help turn the tide, with the report positing interest rates on both sides of the Atlantic are expected to fall in 2024 and are supportive of a new round of capital expenditures. In the end, the downturn in investment is more cyclical than structural. The report also said the U.S. leads in trade of products delivered through data flows, followed by the U.K., France, Germany, India, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. Digging a little deeper in the report unearths this interesting fact. The U.S. currently accounts for more than half the world's operational hyperscale infrastructure, measured by critical IT load. That's a technical reference to cloud and other data storage capacity often associated with companies like Google, Amazon, and Meta. In fact, the report says more than one-third of U.S. hyperscale activity is in one state, Virginia, which has far more hyperscale data center capacity than either China or all of Europe. As Melody and Butch have reported, the all-powerful National Association of Realtors last week agreed to settle a big lawsuit and literally change the way real estate agents get paid, from a standard commission to something truly negotiable. The deal could open up a tightly controlled market to genuine competition and create opportunities for new players and business models in a relatively old-fashioned world. It could do for real estate, in fact, what the internet did for stock trading, bring down broker fees. That'll likely mean lower costs for sellers who brought the lawsuit as a class action. Analysts say the impact on buyers, however, is a tad more complicated. As we know, sellers now pay a 5 or 6% commission on the sale price of their home. Typically, the seller's agent and buyer's agent split the commission. It effectively means the buyer's agent is working for the seller, an inherent conflict of interest. Agents, of course, dispute this characterization and say their reputations depend on them doing a good job for buyers. Which I agree to a certain extent, anyway. Under NAR rules, sellers are required to advertise the buyer agent commission on their multiple listing service. There's even a specific box just for this number. Now, home buyers don't see the numbers, but their agents do. And the risk is that agents are incentivized to steer clients to higher fee deals, putting their interest in a higher fee above the buyer's interest in finding a good affordable house. That box goes away if the court approves this settlement, which is expected, by the way. Sellers could no longer promise a commission to buyer's agents. Now, it seems like a small bureaucratic detail, but the implications are really massive. I mean, most observers believe commissions will fall a lot, possibly to as low as 1 to 1.5% per agent on each side. Now, the settlement could go into effect as early as July, but, you know, the big changes won't happen immediately. It'll take a long time for a truly competitive marketplace to emerge, says Consumer Federation of America's Steve Brobeck, who's pushed for reforms like this for decades. In fact, he believes the industry will continue resisting this. The key question in the post-settlement world is how buyer's agents will get paid. Here are a few possibilities. A flat fee out of the buyer's pocket, or the buyer agrees to pay a percentage of the sales price to the broker or pays an hourly rate, Or maybe they skip having a broker at all. I think that's most likely. The real estate industry is emphasizing that a seller could still actually cover the buyer's agent fee, but that would have to be negotiated later on in the deal process, essentially as a concession. Future home sellers, they're the clear winners here. They should be able to keep more of the proceeds when they sell their house. Another potential winner? Online and discount real estate brokerages that already offer lower commissions. Marty Green, who's a real estate lawyer based in Texas, says you'll probably see a cottage industry of no-frills realtors. But the picture, again, for first-time buyers and those with tight budgets is murkier. They'll no longer get a real estate agent for free and might end up paying out of their own pocket for a service, depleting cash they need for a down payment and other fees. And it's not clear if they can roll an agent's fee into their mortgage. Some say the biggest potential disruption in the real estate industry is if buyers' brokers are replaced by AI robots. They believe a well-trained AI bot would probably provide a better, more reliable service than most human brokers at a tiny fraction of the cost. This is where we are in this crazy world of ours. As many as 2.8 million Americans are licensed as real estate brokers, and even the NAR said in a 2015 report, quote, "The real estate industry is saddled with a large number of part-time, untrained, unethical, and or incompetent agents," unquote. Well, while buyer agents do provide some value to buyers, it's never been clear that the value to the buyer is remotely tied to the amount they're paid. So if a robot can provide, say, 75 to 80% of the value at 1% of the price, that's a bargain many Americans might find attractive. We live in interesting times. Our latest newsletter has hit the streets. I have a piece on NVIDIA's annual artificial intelligence conference, which kicked off yesterday and I believe ended today. It's an event that's drawn so much Wall Street attention, analysts dubbed it the AI Woodstock. In his keynote speech yesterday, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang announced a new generation of AI chips and software for running AI models. The announcement came as the chipmaker looks to solidify its position as the go-to supplier for AI companies. NVIDIA's share price is up fivefold, and total sales have more than tripled since OpenAI's ChatGPT kicked off the AI boom in late 2022. NVIDIA's high-end server GPUs, that's short for graphics processing units, are considered essential for training and for using large AI models. Kif Leswing reports that companies like Microsoft and Meta have spent billions buying their chips. Wang told conference attendees, Hopper, which is the current GPU, is fantastic, but we need bigger, faster GPUs. The company also introduced revenue-generating software called NIM that will make it easier to deploy AI, they say. NVIDIA hopes that that will give customers another reason to stick with its chips over a rising field of competitors like Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, ARM, AMD, and, well, even Intel. NVIDIA spokespeople say the company is evolving away from a mercenary chip provider into more of a platform provider like Microsoft or Apple that other companies can build their software on. In fact, Apple reportedly is in talks to build Google's AI model Gemini into its iPhones. As Hope King reports, Google would gain market share in the AI arms race if it had access to Apple's 2.2 billion devices, the bulk of which are probably iPhones. She says for Apple, inserting generative AI features into smartphones could help build new demand for its devices by making them more fun to use or expanding their uses. In other words, as tech analyst Ben Thompson posits, this partnership, should it come to fruition, makes a massive amount of sense for both sides. Now, the two tech giants already have a long-standing partnership, with Google paying to serve as the default search engine on Apple's Safari browser and the iPhone. But King points out that could also complicate the regulatory picture because, well, that relationship played a big role in the Department of Justice's antitrust lawsuit against Google. And in the big picture, any new AI deal will bring a closer look from regulators here and around the world. Apple has been developing its own generative AI models, as described in a paper published last week. And as Bloomberg has reported, the company is also looking into what features it will put into its next iPhone operating system, iOS 18, expected later this year. King says the company is looking to Gemini and other generative AI platforms to handle features like creating images and writing essays from text prompts. Apple has also reportedly held talks with OpenAI. Reports expected before Apple's developer conference in June. Apple has more than 2 billion devices in active use that could potentially become home to Google Gemini if regulators turn another cheek. Interesting stuff. Oh, hey, by the way, it's Fed Week. Policymaking Federal Open Market Committee is meeting as we speak and will conclude tomorrow. And although it's a virtual certainty again that officials will leave interest rates alone, all eyes are focused on Jerome Powell's press conference tomorrow afternoon. The Fed chair has been somewhat taciturn in describing how the economy has changed since the pandemic. And that's added to rate volatility and making it harder for households and businesses to plan ahead. Sophia Korda Acosta says there are big risks for the Fed coming to grand conclusions. She reminds us how Fed officials are still reeling in a credibility crisis by saying in 2021 that inflation was transitory. And of course, it's presidential election year. So there's a whole slew of political sensitivities ahead where no one side or individual will be immune to being offended. In fact, Powell's experienced pushback just a few weeks ago when he told a congressional committee that immigration had taken some of the pressure out of the labor market. A correct statement, yes. Not necessarily a smart one. Meanwhile, investors of all ilks, who as recently as late December were convinced the Fed would start cutting interest rates this week, have started getting used to the higher for longer reality. And you know what? We all should. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.
Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? Theparamol.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure, but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817.